Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened, happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason. Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Horse?
You know Morse code.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 5, This Place is Death. And very important question this week, at what age could you responsibly enjoy chocolate before dinner? My name is Dave Gonzalez, one of your hosts, and probably around 9, pretty young, when I learned that all food input is just sustenance.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I'd say around 16, because I think that's when I stopped having dinner, like, with the family. And we all were, like, fending for ourselves. That's when I went feral. So, there you go.
And I'm Neil Miller. And honestly, I think it's kind of TBD at this point. Because I still have not proven that I'm responsible with any sort of chocolate or sweets. Especially before dinner. Love to eat some chocolate in the middle of the afternoon, is all I'm saying.
To make a reference to last week, you have to get to the gun at the bottom. Like, how else are you going to be safe if you don't clear
right.
all the chocolate out of the way?
How are you going to defend yourself later in the evening?
That's correct. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. The podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. The first is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you will see time codes listed out handily for each of these sections. Now you know what those are. Thank you so much for supporting us just by, like, listening to the podcast through 5 seasons and 5 episodes, I'm assuming at this point, or, you know, picking it up midstream. It's great. Pass it on. But if you want to support us more, you can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you could also just, you know, support us three hosts, because we do a lot over there that then becomes content that is, like, not about Lost, that is for you. For instance, every week we do a storm chasing podcast where we talk about other pop culture things that are happening to us, around us. Sometimes we eat them in terms of food, not like children. We also have monthly watch-alongs. You can watch a movie with us in our Slack. Our Slack, which is going 24/7 and is filled with all our Patreon.com supported listeners. And a bunch of bonus podcasts with Joanna Robinson. There's Chen Pop for our high-level subscribers. And that's Joanna Robinson and Dave Chen talking about whatever's on their mind when they feel like it, usually about once a week. Depending on, like, politics, it seems recently, I've been enjoying it. Or Joanna and the Buffering Podcast have been teaming up in another special that apparently is now feels like a horny time, pivoting out of comfort and pivoting out of first times into first horny times.
Mm. Yeah, so Feels Like the First Time is a podcast I do with Kristen Russo. For February, we've picked a theme of, like, horny, but we're still trying to figure out, like, what all the movies are. We're definitely doing Magic Mike XXL, which Kristen has never seen. We're probably doing Coyote Ugly, which I've never seen. And we're looking for a third horny movie that is, like, horny, but in, like, but not, like, too horny. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of silly horny. That's where we're Like, you could watch this with your mom and it would be okay. That's kind of what we feel about it. Because people are sending us a lot of, like, really, like, erotic suggestions. And we're like, we're not sure we want to do a live watch of that. So, anyway, you can email us, hostthestormpodcast.com, or tweet at us, or whatever you want to do. If you have any suggestions for that, that's for all of our Patreon subscribers. Kristen and I, like, live watch 3 movies a month, and then we talk about it. It's really fun. We have a lot of emails, a lot of reviews, a lot of things to get through this week. So I will try not to shilly-shally. But, you know, of course, you know you can go to stormpodcast.com if you want to see what we're up to, what the latest thing we're up to is. You can go to Twitter at stormpodcast if you want to vote on our Kistery poll. We'll get to that a little later. If you're listening to us for the first time, you're like, what's a Kistery poll? We'll get to that. And this week in our Patreon Slack on Saturday, Neil will be hosting a live watch of the next week's episode, which is 3/16. So you can join Neil in the Slack on Saturday for that if you are our Patreon subscriber at any level. So let us get quickly to some reviews. We've got a couple positives and one negatives that the boys have given me permission to read. Okay. This one, 5 stars from, so I want to say Sersha _14, but I've heard from other Irish people that Saoirse Ronan is misrepresenting how you pronounce the name.
Whoa, scandal. And
that it should be more something close. I think she does it to, like, allow Americans to feel like they can say it. But anyway, I think it's supposed to be closer to Saoirse rather than Saoirse. Saoirse. But anyway, however you pronounce your name, thank you for the review. 5 stars. Going to give in and finally review this. I've been listening to this podcast since just about the end of the Game of Thrones days, when we were all keenly watching out for the best theories for what turned out to be a thoroughly disappointing finale. When I heard the hosts were moving on to Lost, I was intrigued because one big show I'd never watched as it was airing as a kid. I'm usually a stickler for rules, so tried to keep myself to just the calm until way back in season 1, a long and boring tube ride home one night tipped me over into the storm. After racing through initially, then a long hiatus after season 4, I'm now just about caught up and glad to have a reason to continue on to the end. I still have absolutely no idea what's going on, but I totally love the storm discussion as much as the calm. All of the hosts bring something different, and through all of these unexpected lockdowns, they've proved to be invaluable companions and escape from work when I've been stuck at home. I can't tell you how many meals I've cooked or muddy walks in the park I've taken amidst fiery lock antagonist check-in debates. So all that is to say, thank you for the analysis and the companionship, guys. Would fully recommend. Saoirse, or Saoirse from London. So thank you.
All right.
And it sounds like, I mean, I didn't hear anything about falling down on those muddy walks in the park. So good job to you, my friend. Stay upright. All right. This one, 5 stars. the reviewer's name is Hear You in Another Life, Brother. 5 stars. All storms are one storm. Love this podcast so much. Each of the hosts brings something unique and special to the table, and it's been a pleasure rewatching Lost for the 5th or 4th time with them. My biggest headaches are, one, I can't stop myself from getting ahead of the weekly episodes. Wish we had 2 episodes a week. 2, oh yeah, yeah. This is why I really want to read this one. 2, please tell us whose dog/dogs are occasionally barking in the background. His/her adoring fans are dying to know. 3, please tell me they'll pick another long-running show to watch after Lost. And 4, what are they going to watch next? Thanks for everything, gang. So I will address point number 2 to Neil Miller. Neil Miller.
Oh, yeah. Well, those are 2 rambunctious dogs that live in the same household as me. Nico, who's been around for a while, you know her. And Moira, who is a small terror, is just now finding the limits of her voice. And she's got a lot of it. She's got a lot of attitude. And I'm sure she actually is the most likely one that you're going to hear, because she's.
Yeah,
really
with Nico, it was
got
mostly
a lot going on.
Nico was mostly like jangling collar, right? That's mm-hmm. what we mostly heard from Nico. But Moira is a little chattier.
Oh, yeah.
All right, this last one is it's not that negative, but it's 3 stars from One and Only 97. Good podcast, but they're really low energy. I like the conversations they have sometimes. There's other times when there's a lot of dead air and they seem a little bored and uninterested when discussing a lot of important topics. Joanna, I could tell, tries to keep the energy high, and that's when the other guys are barely contributing to the conversation. So it's just Joanna talking, which isn't bad because I love her, but I like when podcasters are all very enthusiastic about what they're discussing. The first guy, Neil, I think... he meets Dave, the one who does the intro. His energy is really high at the beginning of every podcast, but you could tell his energy dwindles down as the pod goes on. I would understand if they don't want to give too much in the comm section because of spoilers, but even in the storm, their voices seem very much bored of the show and people's emails. Good podcast, but they aren't my go-to when I want to hear someone discuss Lost. I would like it if they perk up a little more and sound more enthusiastic. Thanks for your time. Okay, so...
Is this what it feels like to be tone-pleased, Joanna?
Like I said,
it's a weird experience for me.
I got Dave and Neil's permission before I read that review. Usually the negative reviews were about me, so...
So don't tighten it up, caffeinate more.
What this person is telling me is that loud equals more interested, because that's the difference between me at the beginning of the show and at the end of the show. I definitely feel like several times in the storm I'm trying to explain like the difference between fourth dimensional and fifth dimensional time, and I'm as into it as I'm into anything. But
I will admit to being a little low energy while Dave is explaining the fourth and fifth dimension.
That's fair.
And I know I think I yammer sometimes. So like if Dave and Neil aren't, anyway, I'm gonna try to tighten up to make a little more room for Dave and Neil. And we'll all do better. Or if you disagree with that person, you can leave us a review yourself and say how we're just as loose and perky as we need to be.
Loosen it up. Lower the energy.
That person's at 3 stars. I want that person back at 5 stars. I could do this. I could sound interested in things, especially Lost.
I like Lost. It's a very good show.
I'm going to take this review as constructive criticism.
Great, great. Okay. So we're going to hit a few emails now. This first one comes from Luke, and it is partially calm, partially storm. So here's the calm part. We're now quite deep into the timey-wimey part of Lost, so I was wondering if you could theorize in a calm segment way, how many of the remaining Lost mysteries do you think you could or could not be explained by time travel or time-adjacent Michigas? Could the whispers be time echoes? The moving cabin be time skipping? Is yes. horse question mark a time horse question mark? Etc. So,
this desk a time desk?
Is Electro Walt actually Walt from the future? Anyway, that's a prompt. Neil, what do you think? In your perkiest voice, please.
Oh no, my brain just froze.
Yeah, he was like, what does a perky voice even sound like? And in that moment of doubt, he created more dead air. This is why you don't touch the domino line.
Dave, you go first.
Dave?
Absolutely everything can be explained once you introduce time travel, especially given this episode, because there's like 8 time jumps or something in it, and in some of them we're not even there long enough to determine which time period we are in the island. We could be, you know, prehistory, we could be way in the future. It's all just dark jungle at some point. So yes, I think all of these mysteries could be explained... by like some sort of time blip. I would have a harder time doing the polar bear, but luckily they, I think, fully explain the polar bear with their little cage / cold wheel area.
Maybe. We still aren't sure how the polar bears got to the wheel because it was walled off, right?
I mean, I could make up as much with that as I can with time echoed whispers and time horse, which I love as a concept.
Time horse like I love, but I'm gonna try to one up time horse. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Mm.
It's Mikhail. And each time he comes back from seeming death, it's because he's really just, it's another, every time he dies, it's like live, die, repeat, right? And every time he dies, he gets to start over and try to go again and try to avoid dying this time. That's my Mikhail immortality. And then he ran out of chances when he blew up the looking glass.
Maybe I have one.
All right.
What if the reason why Walt appeared as wet way back when Shannon saw him was because at the time his brain was jumping back and forth through time, and wherever he was elsewhere, he was underwater.
Ooh. I love it.
Yeah.
One last idea. Time spiders. It was time spiders killed Nikki and Paolo, or paralyzed them at least. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean,
it was Sawyer that killed Nikki and Paolo.
I would love to hear from other listeners if they have any calm mysteries that could be explained with time travel.
Favorite time horse.
Time, who would win in a fight, one time horse or 100 time spiders? You let us know.
You decide.
We got an email from Jenny about the lockdown map, but I'm going to read that a little later on when we're closer to that section in the discussion. Okay, so then we got this email from Eric, which is one of the longest things I've ever seen. But guess what, guys? I did my job this week, and I went through, and I think I've edited it down into a readable chunk. Still pretty long, though. Okay. But I think... I think it's really good. Okay, the whole email is really good, but... All right, Eric writes, I think my biggest complaint... this is about... So Eric was inspired to write to us because we said that... I said something, I think, about the idea of whatever happened, sort of taking some of the stakes out of time travel shenanigans in the past. You know what I mean? Like, if they can't change anything, what's going on? Okay. So Eric writes, I think the biggest complaint given was the complaint of stakes being killed by characters not being able to change the past to affect the future. But it's important to consider that stakes can also be too high. In a serialized TV show especially, it is important to find a balance. One analogy I found useful for this story is that of climbing a mountain. If you have a story of a bunch of characters climbing up Mount Everest or something, there's tons of slowly building stakes. There are interpersonal relationships, crevices to traverse, and a slowly dwindling supply of oxygen, putting a ticking clock on the whole enterprise. Every challenge brings a new opportunity for character growth. Now imagine if instead of being able to attack these challenges, they were instead told, if you make one wrong step, you will create a series of avalanches and the whole mountain will collapse and we all die. That would be very interesting in the short term, but would get tedious very quickly if every single challenge, the stakes were, will the mountain collapse? In essence, our characters are climbing up a four-dimensional mountain as opposed to the three-dimensional mountains we are used to here in Normieville. They have a ticking clock of nosebleeds that is slowly ramping up stakes along with crevasses and cliffs of flaming arrows, hydrogen bombs, and all the rest. This only works if we don't have to deal with constantly being worried about the whole universe is going to collapse if they do something wrong. I think the hydrogen bomb is actually a great example here. It would be so jarring if all of a sudden in episode 3 of season 5, they dropped an atomic bomb into the show and the stakes were immediately, will the island blow up? By reducing the stakes, using the mechanics of time travel, they were able to instead use it as a tool to facilitate Faraday's growth into a more assertive and sure character, while also putting a bomb on the island so they can play with it later if they want to. With regards to the individual characters, they are actually very careful to make sure that characters are only rarely in situations where they know what is supposed to happen. Most of the time, these situations are new, even if they happen in the past. Each individual character is still moving through their own experience of time in a linear fashion. See the Hulk explanation in Endgame. Every movement they experience is new to them, so when Locke decides whether or not to shoot Widmore, the mechanics of time travel aren't going into that decision at all. There isn't any universe course correcting or anything. He just never shoots him, and that was always true. It's also key that neither he nor we know that is Widmore, so it's plausible to all of us that he could shoot him for drama purposes. The writers are very careful to only rarely have situations where the characters know the outcomes ahead of time, and they use those to great effect, case in point, the Sawyer-Kate-Claire scene. Instead, the writers are able to have maximum freedom to create situations to drive these characters forward, and I think they're able to do it in great effect. I mean, fundamentally, as a viewer... This isn't that different from a season 1 flashback. We are seeing things that always happened in the past and experiencing them for the first time. It's just in this case, a character that his future experiences is in that flash as well. So there's a little bit more, but I think that's a good start. What do you guys think of all of that?
I think that's all an accurate representation of stakes. I'm just unsure with the difference between micro stakes and macro stakes at this point in like television writing history. We're just starting to, I think, like actually deal with that. We're coming up, you know, on mystery box shows like Lost, where it's important that you be able to see all of it, and so you have your TiVo viewing habits and your digital download viewing habits starting around this show. And then you have, you know, shows like 24 that were also airing around this time. Or I guess on the sitcom side, which is just purely character development with incident, you have things like Arrested Development that are sort of allowing for more complex episode-to-episode character growth. So I think like Lost at this point is really good at doing time travel to make incidents within the episode. The question is if you like sort of are a Storm listener or even finish season five and start to look back, was it like super beneficial? Was everything character accurate to the overall motion of the character? I don't know. I suspect, and as has been my thesis, I don't think we'll find that this time. But I think it's something that we see the writer's room kind of struggling with, just because that's what television was struggling with in the late 2000s.
Neil, do you have any thoughts?
I think the email does a very good job of outlining a little bit about what I find fun about how Lost treats time travel, because I think one of the things I like is waiting to see, as they're flashing through time, what proximity they will have to events we've already seen. Mm-hmm. Or if something looks like it might be close to changing, seeing how the universe or whatever is, you know, course correcting, the stream of time itself is going to do course correcting. I think that's what made like the Charlie and Desmond stuff when Desmond was preventing Charlie's death so compelling. And I think there's a little bit of that in this season where it's like, you know, what every time they flash through, if they get near changing something, would the universe sort of correct for it? And that was just sort of like, it's a fascinating thing to watch for as the seasons go on, you know?
Yeah, no, I like that. I'm going to include one last little chunk because it is in direct response to what Dave said about his feeling about character driving plot or plot driving character this season. Eric wrote, as an aside, I found it very interesting that Dave feels season five is mostly plot rather than character driven, when that was actually my critique of season four in this rewatch. The constant aside, I think season four was almost entirely plot and island mystery focused. There was very little character growth in any of our main characters. Rather, it was kind of just an exercise in moving characters around and giving a bunch of half-assed island mystery info that would basically retcon in the future once they had time to figure it out. Thinking of real character change moments, I can really only think of Desmond, obviously, Ben, and Sawyer that had real change of their character across the entire season. Everyone else was kind of static. The only thing I would disagree with there, I kind of agree with that, but the only thing I would disagree, this is me, Joanna, is I would say Jack, the flash forward provides attention on Jack's journey, right? Because Jack is doing some man of faithing stuff in the flash forward, and he's still very man of silent science on the island, right? So mm-hmm. we're seeing that tension with the flash forwards. I don't think anyone else like really, they have bad experiences, the Oceanic Six, but I don't know that their characters really change all that much. Sun, I guess we're getting like some Dark Sun stuff or whatever, but I don't know. Anyway, just thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think that might be... Oh, one last. Okay. One last email, and then we are good to go. Okay, so this one comes from Derek, who, if you listen to our Small Council names section last week, we double-thanked. And he said because of that double-thank, he's finally writing us an email. So,
nice.
There we go. In the true most 2005 thing, I first discovered Lost while tagging along with a buddy to his drug dealer's house so we could score some weed. I had recently left college in LA and retreated back to my hometown after a heavily impacted film program going nowhere and poor attendance on my part, so I was dealing with my own failures and regrouping back at home, reconnecting with high school friends that never left. I don't remember the exact circumstances, aside from it being close to my birthday and Memorial Day, but we were trying desperately to score some weed. My buddy asked if I'd tag along. We show up at the dealer's house and he invites us in to sit and smoke with his partner. I awkwardly sit down and proceed to sample some product when the girlfriend or wife shushes us to be quiet as it's about to start. Having no clue, but too high to move, I sat there with the two people I just met and pretty much without talking for 2 hours was absolutely wrecked emotionally by Exodus Part 2. Soon after, I torrented the entire first season and binged them so fast I barely remember sleeping. I had never found a show that I had connected with so immediately, and soon I found other friends and people online, shout out to The Fuselage, to theorize and analyze everything. Flash forward to years later when I somehow convinced 20 of my friends and brother to celebrate the show's finale by backpacking into Supai in the Grand Canyon for a week of waterfowl jumping and wandering hikes, which ended with us piled into a Vegas hotel room to watch the finale together. Reactions were mixed, but it will always be a memory that I remember forever. There's the next part, but Dave, do you want to react to Supai in the Grand Canyon?
Oh, I filmed a documentary segment for something in there, and we were not at all well prepared. And so, I have very mixed positive memories of hiking into and out of Supai and staying near the waterfalls.
All right, then Derek says, jumping farther forward to Game of Thrones was another show that hooked me pretty immediately, and I had to dive in more after stumbling upon a cast of kings and being opened up to the Joanniverse and Fitwer. I had found a true weekly listen once Storm of Spoilers was launched. Bringing in all my favorite wackiness of theory, still think Howland Reed is the High Sparrow, and deep spoiler analysis as a smug book reader. After Game of Thrones' disappointing ending, being able to work through those feelings both on the podcast and live at the show in San Francisco was fantastic. Afterwards, both my wife and I were so thrilled that you had to go back to Lost, and we've loved the ride through quarantine and all. It's been as challenging being stuck at home as it is sometimes to resist a binging ahead of the pod, but we remain strong. We love the same wackiness you bring to Lost, all Daves are one Dave, and you're a bright spot in these troubling times, so double thanks to you instead for giving us this enjoyment every week, even when things are tough, and I'm sure you're stressed. You always make time for your listeners, and we'll always make time for you. Parenthood in general, crazy life means I'm not doing live watches very often or just jump in the Slack occasionally for a comment or thought, but I love the community you guys have created. We've been listening to you for so long now that it's hard not to think of you as comforting friends, and I hope you know how much it means to us. After all, it's not about the plot, but the characters. I know this is long and doesn't have any fun theories, that damn outrigger, so no need to read it on the show, but hoping you guys all read it and get a virtual hug if you need it. See you in another life, Derek. So I usually liked that email from Derek.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That was very sweet and, you know, thorough.
So double thanks to you, Derek, for that email. All right. So that's all the emails for me for now. We have a lot more for the storm. We'll see if we get to them. I have earmarked we got so many emails this week, and I've earmarked some of them for the future. Neil's going to do his best to keep me from forgetting that I did that. And until he does, Neil, what happened on Lost this week?
Yes. This episode, This Place is Death, was directed by Paul Edwards and written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. This episode aired on February 11th, 2009, and it takes place on and around and sometimes off the island. speaking of which, off the island, Sun crashes Ben's party by the docks with her gun, and while Ben is able to talk Sun out of shooting him, Kate and Saeed both bail. They have no interest in returning to the island. So Ben and Jack and Son go to meet Ben's friend, you know, from the church. We'll get back to that. On the island, a very much still alive Jin skips through time, witnessing the adventures of young Rousseau and her sexy French science crew. He's there when they're attacked by old Clickety-Clack. He watches things get weird after the French dudes go into a mysterious ancient structure. And then he eventually runs into Sawyer for a little jungle of hugstery. It's good to have the gang back together. And with that gang back together, they head for the Orchid Station so that John can stop the time skipping. Along the way, several noses begin to bleed, and Charlotte falls down. As John and the others look for the Orchid Station, or a well, or whatever, Dan stays behind to hear Charlotte tell him some absolutely insane stuff before she dies, including, but not limited to, the fact that Charlotte grew up on the island in the Dharma Initiative, and when she was a little kid, Daniel was there. After promising Jin that he won't bring Sun back to the island, John Locke falls down a well, experiences a gruesome leg injury, and then receives a pep talk from Christian Shepherd before realigning the donkey wheel of destiny and triggering one more flash. The whole thing ends with Ben and Jack and Son showing up to a church where Desmond has already arrived. It turns out they're all looking for the same person, Daniel's mom, Eloise, and she's going to tell them how to get back to that damn island. Fun fact about this episode, this is the first episode of the entire series in which the character Ben shares any dialogue with either Desmond or Son. He has appeared in scenes with them, but they have never actually spoken up to this point. They are among the few characters to be sharing their first lines of dialogue.
Has he met Desmond before?
No. I think they're in a scene together. There's like a group gathering scene, but they don't actually speak.
Okay.
Earlier in the show.
One of the recaps I read said that like Desmond and Ben had never met before on the show.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know if they've ever been properly introduced at least.
Okay.
All right. So this week's column question, it is revealed in this episode, as we discussed at the top, that Charlotte was not allowed to have chocolate before dinner. I ask you, what is a memorable rule that your parents forced upon you? As a child, I'm happy to start with an example. I remember very vividly that when I was a teenager or preteen, I guess, and we would like go outside and play or go outside and ride bikes around the neighborhood, the rule was when the streetlights start to come on, you got to head home. You need to be home within like 10 minutes. So that was always a very hard and fast rule around my house. So curious if you guys, Joanna, did you have any memorable childhood rules?
It's so funny. As you mentioned that, I was like, oh my God, did I have any rules as a kid? Like, I can't really remember. And I remembered one, which I maybe have mentioned before on a storm chasing, but my sister got a Nintendo when we were kids using her, my parents basically, or my mom, let's say. My mom did not want us to play video games, but my sister like saved up her own babysitting money and got a Nintendo. So my mom could do nothing about that, I guess. But then the rule was we weren't allowed to play it with the sound on. So we played Nintendo. We were allowed to listen to music, but we couldn't like have video game noises on. So we would turn the sound off, listen to musicals, and play video games. So that was a rule in my house. No sound, no video game sounds.
Interesting. I'm going to also pick up on musicals because my mother decreed she would watch me and my brother and then two neighbor boys during the summers. And she would have a cleanup period where somebody got to like play a song on the home sound system, which could be super loud. And while that song was playing, you know, everybody had to like clean up a different room of the house. And so it was a way of getting like a focused, you know, like 2 to 3 minute cleanup from like a whole bunch of kids, except for my little brother, who was really into Broadway and kept picking like 11 minute tracks from the Phantom of the Opera. And we'd all be like, oh man, that's just like so much more cleaning. So every time Kevin got to pick the music, we were cleaned a little bit longer.
That's funny.
All right. We are going to talk about this episode of Lost by starting with all the stuff off the island. We're back at the docks at this showdown. And as we've mentioned before, Son is in a car with Aaron and a loaded gun. But unlike last week, she gets to make a call and we have confirmation that Gian is still okay and is very cute. And is, you know, living her life in Korea, maybe with the dog. Does anybody have an inkling as to where Son's dog is?
I mean, you have to assume that it's with Gian.
With Gian?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Does the dog die.com? I don't know.
I think we get an answer to where Son's dog
is. Yeah, I want to believe, though, that Son's dog is, like her daughter, very well-treated and well-cared for, seeing as Son is a globe-trotting super entrepreneur / assassin now.
Kajillionaire, yeah. I think you started there, or I mentioned last week that Doc Jensen like had this theory that Gian was dead. He spent a lot of his recap this week apologizing to Son. like, I'm so sorry. Sorry I maligned your mothering. I'm sorry, like, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Sometimes that's how it goes in the prediction game, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes John is alive.
Sometimes John is alive. You know who else is alive? Sun learns this week is Jin, as she gets a ring from Ben after a scene where they're driving, where it turns out they don't need to be driving, but Ben is very helpfully moving plot pieces around for next week's episode. I don't think it's the most artful off-island storyline construction, especially because the like major reveal, or I guess all the major reveals of those scenes have their origins on the island storyline.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's good in terms of like interweaving plot lines, but I'm interested if you guys see any benefit of specifically talking about, I don't know, Jack and Son in the car before we jump right to the island and the time.
You mean the scene things. Where Ben is feeling very underappreciated?
Yes, very underappreciated.
I mean, I think that's the thing, right? It's like it feels kind of slight, the off-island stuff this week. Like, not a whole lot happens. They just drive from the docks to the church.
It's just a long delay tactic so that Ben can reveal the ring to Sun after we've already figured out the significance of the ring on island. Mm-hmm. And it's like he has his own in-universe explanation, which is like this was the only way he could lure her to the church or whatever, so he had to do that. But like it really just reads a little silly as like, all right, the show needs Ben to reveal the ring 40 minutes in, so we're going for a drive and there will be traffic. And then when we get there, the ring will come out.
You know who's in that car? Jack and Son, they haven't talked in a while, and she did not want him around Ji-Yeon, so I bet they have something to say to each other. What do they have to say? Oh, exactly what you'd think. It's kind of a little fluff.
Yeah.
The only connection I would say is that, like, you know, Jin and Sun are negotiating, you know, parallel characters in Ben and Locke. Ben very invested on, you know, getting them back to the island. Locke very invested on getting off the island to get to them. And Jin being very invested in Sun staying away. And Sun being invested in finding Jin. Like, there's some nice, like, flip-flop mirror parallels there, but it's not, like, substantially character-rich off-island in any way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I sort of feel like this episode covers a lot of ground, but I think it also is amping up the narrative shortcuts. Time jumps that can happen whenever, you know, you need to. Jin conveniently running around the same like corner of the island as Rousseau's entire backstory. These sorts of things are, I think, good. It's just, I think when you push them this hard and you don't hit each one pitch perfectly, some of the notes could kind of ring a little flat. Ben and Son and Jack stuck in LA traffic that he didn't account for some reason. I don't know. Anyway, let's get to the island.
To that point, I mean, the, so this episode gives us the Rousseau backstory and the Charlotte backstory, both of which were supposed to be their own episodes in season 5.
Yes.
Right? We know that there was supposed to be a Charlotte episode and there was supposed to be a Rousseau episode, and instead they're both parts of this episode. Charlotte's told in a like monologue, you know, and Rousseau's just like the highlights only. And that, you know, has the side effect of making this episode feel kind of jumbled. Like, I like this episode, but there isn't that coherent, like, it's a Sun and Jin episode, which is always, you know, going to be a sort of split episode, right? That's the hallmark of a Sun and Jin episode. But like when we were in the old structure of Lost, even if like the on-island plot was slight or something like that, like Sawyer chasing a boar or whatever, it would thematically link. You know, this is a question Dave asks all the time. Do these two plots thematically link in a way that feels satisfying to you? Not always, but like most of the time you're like, okay, that's what this episode is trying to accomplish character-wise or what have you. And we don't really have this in this episode, even though it's ostensibly a Sun and Jin episode. And that's a function partially of the structure of this season, that they don't have flashbacks or flash forwards. I like the time hopping a lot. And sometimes it's more character reveal effective than others.
Yeah, I definitely think that. It's like, if you're trying to pull a narrative thematic gap over a large space, what you really have is you have Jin, who's back in, like, the 80s most of this episode, and then an indeterminate amount of time, whether it be Orchid Well or a non-existent hole in the ground, and Sun, who's not only 3 years, since they got off the island in the future, but we've also spent an entire season learning what life is like for her off there. So trying to, like, reach back and connect those two things, I think, is one of the downsides of what we were talking about in Eric's email, which is, like, sometimes time travel and character plotting don't connect as cleanly as something like Walkabout's story and Locke being able to, you know, walk. That could sometimes just be, like, simple about, like, he's in a wheelchair in one thing and he isn't in another, but it still creates, like, a palpable sense of mystery because you push that whole episode to be on that one piece of wonder. There's too much wonder. There's too much wonder to spread around, and like laying on a bed of nails, you're able to do it because the wonder is displaced. Maybe? That's what I'm going to feel better about that as we start talking about talking through all the wonders.
I will say that this episode does provide a little bit of ammunition toward the plot before character argument, in the sense that usually, like in the past couple of episodes, when we get a flashback or a flash forward, it's used to, you know, provide some kind of character context. You know, like last week it was the flashback of Kate and Jack talking about taking, you know, what are they going to do with Aaron, that provided us, you know, context for what Kate did in that episode. But in this episode, we don't get any of that. We're getting like pure two. We're just getting the two plots that are happening. We're getting in sort of real time against each other. And the big thing is, like, when's Sun going to really find out that Jin is alive? And I don't know. I don't know if that one quite works, because we know all the other details by the time they get to it. You know, the ring.
I would actually argue that there are some huge character elements of this episode. They just don't belong to Jin and Sun.
That's also fair.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I think John has a huge one. Yeah. We're going to get to that. Mm-hmm. That's at the end.
We're going to get to John, but like Charlotte too, like this is the most interesting Charlotte ever is, a little late, you know what I mean? But like,
so she has Charlotte's only character moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, fair. So there's like stuff in there. And I, you know, if you want to stretch really hard, you can, and sort of look at like the dissolution of Robert and Rousseau and what that makes Jin think about, like, his baby and his wife and this island and what it does to relationships and all. You know, there are ways to connect things, these relationships that are,
I mean, you can definitely see why Jin does not want Sun to come back to the island.
Yeah.
That makes a whole lot of sense. And him being protective of Danielle at the temple makes a lot of sense, just, like, emotionally.
Yeah.
I get it. But then, like, you have all the time travel stuff. All right, let's stick with Charlotte, since Charlotte doesn't move around, and so we can kind of just talk about her. All
she falls
from
down,
where she
and
lands.
That's it.
Yeah, she falls down, and then spends some time talking to Daniel, falling down. But this is Charlotte's real exit this time. She got time skipped out, and she Daniel's theory about how time travel on the island works are correct. This means that, you know, Charlotte has spent the most time on the island. So as she's on her way out, we get an explanation of that, and we get her backstory about her family and the Dharma Initiative, and then her and her mom moved away, and then her mom sort of made her try to forget the Dharma Initiative, but couldn't gaslight Charlotte, who became an anthropologist for some reason, and seeked out the island once again. Also has a memory of a scary man who is probably Daniel, given what we saw in the premiere of this season, who told her if she ever came back to the island, she will die. So I think, much like we've now closed the compass time loop, I think Charlotte's death also narratively suggests a time loop.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really reasonable conclusion if my memory serves, and I'm going to check this right now. I don't think she mentions the Dharma Initiative.
No, she does.
Yeah. No, she does. She does. Yeah. You're right. Okay. Then, yeah. I agree. We haven't seen everything, but like the fact that we saw Dan in the Dharma Initiative time and Charlotte and her fam were in the Dharma Initiative. So, yeah.
And it seems, a time loop would suggest that there's like an object that's seeded by another object, but it's not. This is a Daniel Faraday's whatever happened paradox, because in the future, presumably, in Daniel's future, but our past, he's presumably going to try to get her to not come to the island.
Mm-hmm. It's also the first time that a character is saying that they remember something from the past that involves these characters
somebody
that are experiencing
the future.
Their mm-hmm. future. So I think that's, you know, that's notable.
Do you guys think it took Charlotte that long to find the island because she decided to be an anthropologist and not a geographer or a geologist or a cartographer?
Do you think the only thing she could remember was that there were bears and that she had to find the bears?
But then I would be a zoologist. I don't know that I would be an anthropologist. You know what I mean? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know what did she see on that island and made her think like the study of peoples would help out here. We also have discussed, at least in the storm, I think, the idea that Charlotte's on the fridging scale somewhere, in terms of dying to provide character motivation to Dan. And maybe we talked about it in the calm because she has had some very close calls with her nosebleed and time disease.
I think talked about it in the storm. But like, honestly, I think sorry, I don't mean to cut you off from that, but I think that's something we're going to be able to discuss even more once we see how, because she dies in this episode, but we don't see the impact of that death yet, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it is true that the Dan Charlotte thing, especially I've noticed on the rewatch, and I don't remember feeling this way necessarily about it the first time around. It feels like a one-sided deal. You know, like everything, all the Dan's crush on Charlotte, and you know, I think it's all being processed through the lens of like Dan's experience. You know, so now that she's dead, that's the only place left.
No, it's true, and I think that like narratively, story wise, there is a reason for Charlotte to die here, and it's to put a ticking clock on everyone else we care about with a nosebleed on this island, mm-hmm. right? So, like, that feels narratively important.
If you have all those characters up in a wall and you're like, you have to kill one, I would have also picked Charlotte.
But it's too bad, and I really do wish she had gotten her own episode in season 5.
Yeah.
I think that Rebecca Mader is great, and it's just really bad, too bad that like the most interesting thing about Charlotte happens right as she dies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, let me tell you my life story. You're like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh, by the way,
because, well, can we talk about the various diseases we're dealing with in this episode?
Sure.
Because there definitely are multiple.
Right. Charlotte's brain comes unstuck in time at a certain point, right? Which is like similar to what which is similar to what happened to Minkowski mm-hmm. and to a certain degree Desmond, right?
And Teresa.
But like, is the freighter sickness the same as the time flash sickness? Is that what we're saying? And then, but both of those sicknesses seem to be different from the smoke sickness, because the smoke sickness like brainwashes you. And that's mm-hmm. different. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel like the time disease and the freighter disease are like a similar kind of, you know how there are different types of like cancer? Okay. So like they're in the same class of disease, but they seem to process at different speeds, right? Because the Minkowski and Regina were meant to believe that like that happened fairly quickly. Whereas these other folks have been on the island for a long time and it's only after the flashes started, and then it sort of depends on how long they were there before, you know. But yeah, I mean, they feel very similar. They feel very unstuck, you know.
But not the same as the smoke sickness. It's just stuff when, like...
Because the smoke sickness has, at the in this episode, Robert wanting to shoot Danielle, who is pregnant with his child. So I feel like he takes a... He does a full 180 after coming out of that, as I said, ancient structure. Ancient-looking structure.
It's like when they put the green worm and Chekhov in the Star Trek. That's what I think of the smoke sickness being, right?
Yeah, it's like a...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It causes you to...
It compels your will to do something
different. You're in the thrall of something.
Mm-hmm.
And that something seems to be pretty evil, if you ask me.
I'm still trying to think through this time disease versus freighter disease. Because I think, like, the cause of death is the same, which is your brain... And your consciousness sort of like decouple because they can't take it. But the difference is the freighter disease seems to decouple your consciousness and send it jumping through time. Whereas the time disease, they're physically jumping through time. Like their consciousness isn't unbound from the brain for as long.
Well, yeah, but so at the end, Charlotte is saying things like that sound like they're from the past.
You know? And that's like the end of it, if it's like some sort of whereas like the freighter people, they get there first and they're able to exist for a long period of time, like sort of just not knowing what time it is before it physically takes a toll on their brain.
I kind of like this idea of the island can give you multiple kinds of cancer. You get freighter cancer, time cancer, or smoke cancer, and they have different impacts on you.
Yeah.
The island is studying the anthropology of putting tumors in people's brains.
The island is an oncologist. It's fine.
All right. So we have Charlotte. We have Charlotte passing away. But while Charlotte's passing away, Locke is still on a mission to get to the Orchid and stop the time skippings by bringing everybody back, which is what he's been told by Richard that he needs to do. And then he assumes he could do that by moving the island. We learn when he gets there, maybe he should have been very specific about what he'd heard in terms of instructions. But we do get a lot of time hopping around the Orchid station and get to see it in like three different states. Does anybody want to guess how we can mark these three different time periods?
Isn't it the future, the past, and maybe something like the present?
Yeah, so like post-Dharma initiative, because we got to have a Orchid station. Pre-Dharma initiative, but humans have been on the island.
Right.
Somebody's dug a well.
Yeah.
And then... Pre-well, where I don't know if how we think about the frozen donkey wheel as being an extraterrestrial structure or not. So let's assume somebody's maybe been on the island, but definitely pre-well. So I'm fine with future, present, and past, but I think it's more like future,
past
and prehistory.
Yeah, I just think that what's important is that no matter when it is, no one ever thought to put a damn ladder in this place. Everyone has to just fall.
Well, whatever happened, Neil. You can't go back to the Orchid now and be like, let's build this ladder here, just in case we're ever time jumping again. I mean, yeah, that's a good point. I guess if anybody would have been holding a ladder as he time jumped, the ladder would have then gone with them, as we see with Sawyer and the rope in one of the... A thrilling but also kind of hilarious scene where it's just cut to Sawyer holding onto a rope that goes directly to the ground.
I just want to point out this is yet another moment. There's like a lot of moments you can see where the only person who can like calm Sawyer down or reason with him is Juliet. And he's like freaking out about the rope, right? And she's just like, James, we can't help Locke wherever he's gone. We can't get there. So
yeah. Juliet is the best therapist on the island.
Oh, R.I.P. Libby.
Yeah, Ann Harper. Eat shit, Harper. Yeah.
Eat shit, Harper.
Eat shit, Harper. We don't even think you were alive. We don't even know if you're but a live person on this show.
I want a shirt that says "Eat shit, Harper." That chick sucked. All right.
All right. That down under the ground, John, compound fracture, gets met up by Christian. Here in the notes it says, Christian can't help John up. Is he non-corporeal? How does he hold that lantern then? Is a good question that I'm guessing Joanna
is the lantern wrote. Non-corporeal as well?
I'm going to add another question. How is Christian Shepherd there?
He's a ghost.
How is Christian Shepherd anywhere? Is the question
ghost that
of
could travel
lost.
Through time? That ghost knows what John Locke said in a cabin in another point in time when there was a ladder down to that cave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's also like been in that cabin. And similarly, like, why would he take the form of Christian Shepherd to talk to John Locke when John Locke doesn't know what Christian Shepherd looks like?
Mm-hmm.
Just a question. A question here for the calm.
I'm just saying we now have like a crazy time travel zombie who has some sort of consciousness, or he's non-corporeal and has been jumping with our very corporeal losties. Lots of questions.
Do you
Buffy,
think well, I have
the
a
final
question.
Season of Buffy has always made me very conscious of what's corporeal and what's not, because that was the like main question of the final season of Buffy. So I'm always curious. Seems to me that Christian is not corporeal, but maybe that was just like an emotional thing. If I can't help you up because you have to do it yourself, sort of thing.
It does work because I'm not thinking about, is that a time ghost while I'm watching it? Because the John Locke determination to walk to his death and turn a mysterious donkey wheel works. I don't want to spoil the John Locke antagonist check-in, but I don't think he's an antagonist here.
I don't think so either. I actually think the more important question here is, what do you think John Locke thinks that is? Like, does John Locke think that this... Because in the cabin, Christian Shepherd said, like, I'm, like, friends with Jacob, right? So does
yeah, I'm
so
Christian, I can speak for Jacob.
You almost have to feel like up until the point where Christian says, say hello to my son for me, John is like fully in belief that maybe this is like the island or Jacob. So I don't think John doesn't seem very concerned about the corporealness of his new friend. He just seemed, you know, he's full on man of faith to whatever the island is going to tell him.
Oh, totally.
Remember last week when I was like, I would like John to see the scene where Jack and Sawyer talk about who Jack's dad is, and someone was like, Dave, why would John need to see that?
For this exact moment to make any sense. Where
maybe
Christian's
I
like,
accidentally
my son.
Make a point sometimes.
But it's, oh, I guess Sawyer did say like... His name was Dr. Shepherd. What did he say? Did he say his name is Christian Shepherd?
Yeah, I think he might have said Christian.
His name is Christian Shepherd, and he's a silver fox with a sort of distinguished swoop of hair. Look out for him, will you?
Yeah. Like also, I do think it's kind of funny that all of this timey-wimey skipping nonsense is because the donkey wheel is off his axis. Like, that is just, it's the donkey wheel isn't sitting correctly, so we just
Ben blooped out before he pushed it the full way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't that John was really the one who had to do it, it was that Ben did it wrong.
I mean, I think it could go either way. Maybe, you know, Ben did it wrong because John was the one who had to do it. Because it also seems like, you know, John's able to, with a broken leg, I mean, John has a lot of experience with not working legs, so he's able to properly leverage. Leverage himself for that final turn.
This is the second significant leg injury of the season for John Locke.
It is, and just in general, John's legs don't fare so well on the island. That seems to be the best way to test John Locke's resolve, is to take away his ability to walk there for a second, and then tell him he can't do something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we told him what he has to do, and he's done it.
Yeah, and he did
have
it.
Have you tried negging John Locke? It works really well.
Yeah. John Locke versus Bugs Bunny would be a whole series of cartoons that would definitely result in some sort of hijinks. All right. That's the John Locke of it all. Let's talk about Jin and Danielle. We pick up, and there's a debate amongst the French crew and Danielle and Jin what to do next. Jin wants to go to the camp because he thinks the helicopter could have landed there, because Jin is 4 episodes behind us in terms of knowledge. Which doesn't make for the best drama, but you know what does? Figuring out what happened to Danielle and her team. Neil summarized it, but they do end up sort of at there's some flirting where we get to meet Danielle's
Alex's dad.
Alex's bio dad. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Some talk about a canteen that reveals that Nadine is missing because a clickety-clack. And Jin is the one who calls it a monster, which is interesting to me because later on, Danielle calls it a security system, which is defined for her later in this episode when What's-His-Face is like, it's not a monster, a security system.
Robert.
And then...
Yeah.
Yeah, Robert. And then later when Danielle's chasing Jin off, she accuses like him of being the source of the disease. So I like how we've seen Danielle's backstory from season 1. We've seen what happens to Montrad's arm and whatnot with a little bit more context into how there are multiple island diseases and how this is not the disease, as we thought the first time we encountered Rousseau. That infects pregnant women and requires a vaccine.
Forgot about baby disease. I'm uncomfortable with cancer, so I'm going just back to like smoke disease, Thyme disease, mm-hmm. Frayer disease,
sure.
Baby disease. Yes.
Baby disease.
Yep.
So that's our fourth disease that we now learn is a different disease entirely from the one that Rousseau was warning us about in season 1. I like this. I think Neil was bringing up like one of the interesting things in time travel is like sort of getting to touch on things that you know and like getting to see them from a different angle. I think those two things and this sort of prick that same part in the brain that like a successful cameo does in like a movie. It's like, hey, I know that. I get that reference.
Every time Ethan Rome shows up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm like ramping up my recap rereads the more we go on. I used to just read one, now I read about 5 every week because I found like 5 recappers I really like, and a lot of them were dissatisfied with the fact that like we don't learn anything new about Rousseau. We just see what we already knew about Rousseau. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what I do like seeing it from her point of view, because when she tells the story to Saeed back in season 1, we're supposed to be like, this lady is unstable. And then we see everything she goes through, right? Like, they crash on this island, Nadine falls out of a tree, Monton gets his... sucked down a hole, gets his arm ripped off, Jin disappears into thin air.
He's still alive! He's just badly burnt!
There are 2 dead Frenchies on the beach by the time we come back to her, with flies gathering around them, Robert betrays her, and then Ben steals her baby later. So, like... You know, I think we've been pretty good at being sympathetic to Rousseau throughout. But if you weren't, if you were writing her off as some, like, nutcase in the woods, like, okay. this lady went through a lot, all right? And what she did with the rifles was smart and right. And she should have done it. So, you know.
I think that's what makes this as, like, it's a flash by, you know, Jin flashing by Rousseau's origin story.
I saw someone call it a time travel pensieve, which is like,
that's a fancy.
When Harry sees all the relevant moments from Snape's life, yeah.
But yeah, I think one of the reasons why bringing Rousseau back works is because it's a character that another character like Jin can have contact with, and then when it comes time to ask that question that we constantly have to ask every time they get anywhere near someone they know, is like, why wouldn't they remember that? You know, why wouldn't they remember that in the future? And it's like, well, Rousseau's a perfect candidate because she's gone through so much trauma and so, yeah. and she's lived on her own for 16 years after all the trauma in the jungle that is still very scary. So of course she wouldn't remember Jin. You know, like a lot happened to her after Jin disappeared in the thin air.
Yeah, to her, Jin was probably like the first of many things she's seen that she's convinced are now not real on this island.
Yeah, so I think it's a really good, it's a really clever angle for the writer's room to take. And, you know, I think it's, it doesn't, the recappers are right that it doesn't add anything to like the character or story of Rousseau, but it does, as we see this new structure, it does unfold a little bit more of what's going on the island for us. And I think that's important.
We can talk, you've been very careful and polite, Neil, about tiptoeing around it, but we can talk about what the structure is, actually.
Sure. The ancient structure.
Yeah, because Robert calls it a temple, and the temple. And we've heard of the temple a number of times before this episode.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that the kids and what's her name are at the temple.
Cindy and the kids, yeah. Ben sends the other there. That's where he's trying to get Rousseau to take Alex and Carl. He draws a map to the temple. So we've heard about the temple a number of times, and then
there is an additional wrinkle that I don't know if I should even introduce, but let's do it because Lost was a show that was talking about itself while it was airing on the official podcast for this week, and it's not our excerpt. They're like, is that the temple wall? And they're like, it's an outer wall. Maybe you have to walk a little bit to that before you get to the temple.
It is an outer wall. It's true. It is technically the temple outer wall. That's true.
And it's got a Cerberus hole or Cerberus port.
Vent.
vent.
Yeah. Which we learned about.
No, I like hole. It's like a Hume hole.
Like a Hume hole.
Island's full of holes.
We learned about that from the lockdown map, which brings me back to an email we got from Jenny. The title of her email is Musings on Mystery Spaghetti and More. She goes, hey guys, it's a little late to this party, so I've been going back, rewatching, re-listening to old episodes as I have the time. I'll still keeping up week to week with the new stuff. This weekend I watched season 5, episode 5, This Place is Death, but I also watched season 2, episode 17, Lockdown. First of all, I have to agree about the blacklight map being an iconic screenshot moment. I watched the episode as they aired. For this one in particular, I bought the episode on iTunes for my iPod video just so I could pause it at that moment. And boy, did teenage me torture herself over that map. I'm pretty sure I even tried to draw it myself based on what I saw on my little iPod screen. I was 16, don't at me. But you all also talked about how a lot of the stuff on the map and in the hatch is mystery spaghetti, including the hieroglyphics that appear when you don't push the button. I mean, seriously, what was up with that? But when I was watching season 5, episode 5, This Place is Death, to prepare for this week, I noticed that when Jin is standing near the wall of the temple with the Frenchies, there are some hieroglyphics etched into the wall, including the bird symbol, which I know we see in the hatch countdown clock as well. I'm sure there are some corners of the internet that have already delved into the translation of the hieroglyphics, so I won't get into that. But as you mentioned, maybe Dharma Initiative engineer who was responsible for programming the button came across the symbols that were etched on the wall of the temple, and that's how they ended up in the hatch's countdown clock? Question mark? Who knows? But anyways, I just thought that was an interesting connection between the two episodes. I'm sure we see hieroglyphics in other episodes as well, so apologies if you've already covered this in another Storm episode. Keep up the great work, and never tighten up. And then Jenny made a suggestion for us to interview a commie when everything is said and done about their experience all the way through. So we might just do that. But
I mean, I like this one a lot. I also think that it could. Okay, so who did we see ultimately who's drawing the lockdown map? It's mostly Kelvin, right? He did a lot of work on it. And
yeah.
Rousseau, when we meet her in season 1, is not that far from where our Losties crash landed and where they ultimately find the hatch. So maybe Kelvin was wandering around the jungle and he found the temple wall and then drew on the back of the door. Or whoever was there before him as well.
This is the dark territory that Rousseau describes in season 1. Like when she's taking them to where... to the Black Rock to find the dynamite. She's like, this is the dark territory. And she's like, this is where Montand lost his arm and stuff like that. So that's definitely like where they are, is what Rousseau calls the dark territory. But yeah, and the Cerberus vents are so interesting, right? Because that was, so that was like a thing on the map, is like they have these little notations, CV, that stand for Cerberus vent, which is the spots on the island where the smoke monster comes up out of the ground.
Yeah, where the lock almost got pulled into one in season one.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Cerberus being the three-headed dog that guards the underworld, we see, I mean, we definitely get an underworld moment in this episode with Locke and Christian talking about needing to die and death and all that sort of stuff like that. And Christian with his lantern is like a classic, like, underworld guide sort of figure. And that's all really interesting. The last thing I'll say about that is that the hieroglyphs down, I was reading about this, that the hieroglyphs down in the Donkey Wheel area, these aren't actual hieroglyphs. So you can try to translate them if you like, but they're made up, so they're not real. But Damon Lindelof said that the hieroglyphs down in the Donkey Wheel cavern translate to reincarnation. He said this in like before whenever this episode aired. So I feel like it's fine for me to say that. Mm-hmm. So the hieroglyphs down the Donkey Wheel say something about reincarnation, and there are similar hieroglyphs on the temple wall. So this idea of reincarnation, we know there was an anagram for reincarnation right
on Ben's truck.
So just thinking about reincarnation as a concept through hieroglyphs, I guess.
Indeed. All right. Is there anything we want to pick up before we get to corners, Joanna?
You know, we're talking a lot about Sawyer's redemption arc, right? And how he's on a great redemption path. His lingering racism crops up in this episode, and but I do like that Miles makes fun of him for it. It used to be like he would just say racist stuff, and it wouldn't get like that interrogated. Or we were just sort of being like, oh, this guy's supposed to be a redneck. I get it. But the fact that, like, Miles just makes fun of him for it is pretty great. Mm-hmm. Classic Miles and Sawyer dynamic that I like. I think we should just flag the fact that Ben sees Desmond, and we know that Ben is, like, looking to hurt Penny. So that's just something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
When Ben sees Desmond, like, because Desmond might not know who Ben is, and he certainly probably doesn't know that Ben has any interest in his wife Penny, but
well,
we know that.
I mean, I think it goes both ways, because Ben's like, oh man, I could use it to get to Penny, but then also, like, Desmond walks up and is like, so you're also looking for Eloise Hawking? And Ben's like, oh fuck, that's my card. That's the card I have to play.
Well, you know, somewhere Ben has a file on Desmond.
Oh, for sure.
For sure. Absolutely.
Maybe an entire filing cabinet,
right,
on Desmond. So.
Well, Ben could always see into the station, so he's very familiar with Desmond.
Oh,
he's
that's
been
true.
Watching Desmond push the button the entire time Ben's been there.
That's true. Yeah, and I had some other stuff, but it's not really that important.
Jen and Sawyer hug, Raft Bros. That seems important.
I mean, it's a beautiful hug. Whenever the Raft Bros, like when Jin saw Michael on the freighter, like whenever the Raft Bros are reunited, it's sort of like, it means a lot. It's just kind of incredible how much that little raft trip that only lasts like an episode, how like foundational. I mean, I guess they went down the Tiger Pit together as well, but like how foundational and bonding that whole era of the show was for these characters.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
How Jin and Sawyer should not get on any boats. So that just ends with them back on the island having a hug about barely surviving.
I mean, they are both very good at not drowning, despite very, very, very torturous circumstances on the high seas.
They will keep their pants on and not drown somehow. It's amazing.
We did try to explain last week where Jin was the whole time, and then Dan did the same thing in this episode. So hopefully everyone now understands what Jin was up to this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Just floating around, having a little
floating and,
little
and blipping and floating.
All right, this week's Jungle of Mystery moment. We have a few picks here, but I am going to pick of these. How did Charlotte know about the well? I've got questions about time travel. I've got questions about Charlotte. How did Charlotte know about the well? Our Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award for a while looked like it was going to go to poor Nadine's body, but no, John Locke unsuccessfully climbs a rope.
Man, even Charlotte gets overlooked in this one.
Yeah, Charlotte does get
overlooked. Charlotte will have her corner moments to shine, I think.
So John Locke and his protruding fibula gets the Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award. This week's accent corner, Joanna. There's a couple, it seems.
Well, we're going to do the Frenchies really quickly. But I just wanted to shout out Charlotte's Klingon. I wish we had gotten to hear it so we could judge her Klingon accent, but we didn't. All right. So there are five non-Rousseau Frenchies. Brennan and Lacombe, who are those like fly-ridden corpses on the beach. We're not going to deal with them right now. Okay. Because they're like barely theirs, right? So we've got Robert. Monton, who is a misogynist asshole. By the way, I finally found a woman who was recapping that I really liked reading, and she was just like, she spends like paragraphs calling out Monton for being like a misogynist asshole, and none of the other recappers mention it. And Doc Jensen was like, poor Monton. I was like, no, that guy was an asshole, and I was glad he died. Anyway.
Yeah, he's a dick. They rip his arm off, and it seems fine.
Yeah. All right. So we've got Robert, Monton, and Nadine, our three Frenchies. Are they actually French? Neil.
I'm going to go 0 out of 3 are French. I don't think any of them are French at all.
Okay. Dave.
They don't speak any English in the series, except maybe Robert does last episode. So I'm going to say yes, all three are French.
All three French. So 0 to 3. The truth is more complicated. So Nadine, it's hard to find out. The actress is named Alexandra Tabas. I think she's Hawaiian. She went to University of Hawaii. She says aloha a lot on her personal website. So I think that person is Hawaiian. We've got Monton, the misogynist asshole. That guy, Marc Menard, is Canadian. So
French-Canadian,
right? And then lastly, we have Robert, played by Guillaume Dapignon.
Oh, that sounds extremely French.
That is a Frenchie. So one French, one French-Canadian, and one Hawaiian. That's our, is this
one
a Frenchie?
And a half.
Yeah, exactly. The exact exact midpoint between your two guesses. That's what we have for Accent Corner.
This week's I Married Her Coincidence Corner. See, is that energy or is that just loud?
It was
I can't
great.
Tell the difference. Okay, good. All right. Is Dan's mom is Desmond's time cop lady. It's Eloise Hawking, a name we don't have to bleep on the podcast anymore. I'm thrilled as that doesn't have to happen.
Desmond looks thrilled, I'll tell you that much.
Desmond does look thrilled. All right, the Nosebleed Watch 2020. We still
2021,
have
Miles, Dave.
Juliet. 2021. Oh yeah, thank God. Sorry guys. Nosebleed Watch 2021. Miles, Juliet, James still under threat of nosebleed. Charlotte dead of nosebleed.
And I think this is
slash time disease.
This Dan's is the first bleeding, time right? we get Sawyer, right?
Yeah, Sawyer's joined the corner, but Dan's not bleeding, right? It's just Miles, Juliet.
Does
and
yeah? It doesn't
yeah,
seem
we haven't
like
seen
it.
Dan.
Yeah.
Sawyer is the first of our losties, but presumably, Jin and Locke would not be far behind.
Yeah.
Given that we've now caught time disease has caught up with like 90 days on the island,
right.
or however many days they've been
815 survivors. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we're at about 112 days, if my math is correct.
Nice. So the one it's reached 112 days, and it's time disease.
Time to bleed.
Infection race. Yeah. Time to bleed. Book club, Joanna. We got a book club.
Yeah, we have this great long email about Narnia that I'm going to read later. I have put it in my future emails folder. I will not forget to read it. We don't have time this week, despite the fact that this is the Charlotte Stapleton Lewis week. So we will talk about Narnia in the future.
I forgot about the Stapleton thing.
Yeah.
Joanna, I'm also gonna make you read our Henry Gale Memorial UCLA Award.
All right, I'm gonna do my best. I'm gonna butcher it though. Okay, je t'aime, Danielle. Je ne veux que rien nous arrive à toi et à notre bébé. Je t'en supplie, fais pas ça. And that's from Dark Robert, which says something like, "I love you, Danielle. I've never hurt you, our baby. Please don't do this." And then he points a rifle at her face.
And pulls the
He's
trigger.
Lying, Robert. Lying in French, even worse. Ugh. Anyway.
Should have checked Danielle's his firing pin.
I'm going to pull that on some very good people in the future. All right. It's a woo-loo-loo. The best time travel moment is that exact thing. Taking the firing pins out of Robert's rifle pays off. Much like the trick she did on Saeed, which is when we first heard about it. We got to see it. It was pretty sweet. We also get to see the music box, which somebody enjoys. And I do not remember my first watch through
it's when how she, prominent that was. In the episode where she captures Saeed, right? She's got the music box, and that's one of the first things he hears when he wakes up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open on the beach when Jin shows
and
up.
And he fixes it for her. Right? So he fixes... Okay. All right. I remember the music box.
The music box. All right. It's time for that jungle of kistery. If this is your first time joining us, this is where we get to decide who kisses on the island. And by we, I mean all of us, because we put it up for a Twitter vote. Joanna, how do we do last week for the episode The Little Prince?
Oh, it went exactly as you thought it might. All right. So the Le Petit Prince, getting only 10% of this vote on Twitter. You can go to twitter.com/StormPodcast to vote on these every week. Saeed and the Nurse Assassin only got 10.7% of the vote, despite the fact that like they really looked like they might kiss for a second there. Kate and Son only got 12.8% of the vote. So no love for the gal pals here. Jin and some chapstick, 24.8% of the vote. Pretty okay. And our producer Diana did a visual aid with that one. I don't know if you guys saw. She liked to post the poll. And then the next tweet was like, Jin's chapped limbs. Just in case people forgot how chapped he looked when he got ashore. But running away with 51.7% of the vote in a true Penny and Dez kind of way, it's James and Juliet. So there we go. Tough to beat. All right. So this week... we do not have Penny. Oh, was that Moira?
Or yeah, it was.
Moira! All right, Moira has history opinions. Okay, so this week, we do not have James and Juliet. We don't have Penny and Dez, so we'll see how other folks do. We've got John and Christian, the underground distinguished gentleman.
Assuming that they're both corporeal.
Yeah.
Good point. We've got Jin and Sawyer, Raph Bros, hugging it out. We've got Rousseau in the unsmoked Robert, like when he was being really nice, when he was like in stark contrast to that misogynist pig Monton, Robert was being really sweet about their bébé, etc. R.I.P. Robert.
He would have made a good real dad for Alex.
Yeah. And last but not least, this submission comes from Dave's mom, Liz. She said smoky, and she said French people, but I'm changing it to French food. So smoky and some French food.
It's like smoky and the beignets.
Yeah.
Smoky and some French food in the Severus vent.
Exactly. So there you go.
Into it. All right. You could, vote on Twitter. As Joanna said, we're going to push forward with some corners. Here we go. Charlie Pace Memorial Final Awards Award goes to Dear Charlotte, who says, I'm not allowed to have chocolate before dinner. Will we ever figure out at what age that was? Who knows? Because we are still jumping
through young.
She did sound kind of young. Carl's Memorial Coming Right Now Actbreak Award. Also goes to Charlotte, who says, in what I believe is a sequence that she's actually saying in Korean and we get to see it translated, this place is death. She says it to Jin.
Well, doesn't she say it again in English right away?
She says it again in English, yeah. She says it both.
It's a good one. And honestly, the only better like cutaway, which isn't a break, is when Jin says monster. But I think it cuts to another scene. It's not an actual break. So
no, it's an act break.
Is it?
Well, I was looking through the transcript, and they have like the act break set, like, and it's right before an act break.
Well,
I almost picked that one, but I think This Place's Death is better.
They're both very good this week.
They're both very good.
That's the title of the show.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it's time for this week's official podcast check-in. It's a mini one. I will be reading Carlton Cuse, and you'll be reading Damon Lindelof. This is from the podcast that aired before next week's episode, 316. Carlton Cuse. All right, this is sticking with my theme. This is from Jesse in Toronto, Ontario. Hey guys, one of your loyal Canadian fans here. Damon just had a question from season 4, episode The Other Woman. During that therapy session with Juliet and Harper, Harper mentions that Juliet looks like her. I was wondering if this was a reference to either Ben's mother or Ben's childhood friend, Anne, both of whom share resemblance with Juliet. Thanks.
It's a very insightful question, and I think hopefully you'll be getting the answer before the series is over, but you're asking exactly the right question. My therapy says that basically your mother is the only one who counts. So you keep sort of trying to replicate that through your life.
Okay. And scene. What does that mean? Who knows? Maybe we'll talk about it in the storm. The only way to find out.
I guess
out
that means it's listening. Ben's mom, right? I don't know.
But presumably, Damon Lindelof's therapy is focusing on what your parents do to you, which I feel very much tracks with the show we're watching right now. All right, we'll be back for the storm right after this.
Is there something, maybe a smoke monster or a time-hopping island, interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? That's a little bit of a flippant intro, but there is some serious need for mental health going on in our world right now, given all the real-world events that we are dealing with. And BetterHelp, that's H-E-L-P, will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. This is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. And also, P.S., you should still be at home because a pandemic is still happening. And this service is available for clients worldwide.
That means you don't have to trek to any cabins or old Dharma stations. You could just log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy and the time before when we were allowed to be inside with each other like that. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
And if you'd like more information, you can jump on your Dharma computer and visit their website and read testimonials that are posted daily to betterhelp.com/reviews, like this one about a counselor named Stella. And I quote, "I have been working with Stella for a couple weeks now. Since starting with her, my anxiety has decreased. I feel seen and heard. She provides me with great science-based resources that help me better understand myself. She is compassionate and caring." And for our listeners, you can visit betterhelp.com/storm. That's better, H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Once again, you can go to betterhelp.com/storm and get 10% off your first month.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and the Storm listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/storm. Now is the time on the podcast, before the storm, but after the calm, when we like to thank our small council subscribers. These are the folks that get to listen to Chen Pop. They get to watch movies with us. We watched Hunt for the Wilder People. It was delightful. These are the small counselors. We got some new folks, so let's start there. We got Dan Janes and Rushi B. We've got, or maybe Ruchi, I don't know. Let me know if I messed up that pronunciation. We've got Richard Sobel. We've got Sam Padme, Laura Caruso, Anne Ledford. Hi, Anne. Ashley Warren, Christopher Reynaud, Sarah Wingo, Gwendolyn Gardner. I almost made that French. It's not. Stephanie Breitbach, Becky McMorrow, Matt Campbell, Bronwyn Beck, Aaron, Jeremy M. Johnson, Joe Torrens Fernandez, Kelsey Elmiger, and Jennifer Barrett. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to thank Hayden Simpson, Grace Vixington, Liz Wilson, C.S., Paul Cole, DeAlton Dane, the new Sword of the Morning, Claire D., Sarah Holiday, Javier Ernesto Fuentes, Kristen Plant, Mark Marquez, Miranda Blankenship, Kyle Davis, Sean Nee, Matt Thompson, Davia Giannini, Zoe Fuchs, Sharon Deegan, Robin Mayer, and Deborah Ackerman. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Florence, Rick Russell, Renee, Nathan Melahan, Jenny V, Robert Dufour, Rafa Machi, I feel like that's close, Brandon Turner, Joy Novak, Diana Byrne, Jenna Clark, James Stout, Catherine Huey, Rosemary, Shauna Evans, Sandra, Casey Ogle, so pretty, Jennifer Holloway, SM, and Eric Stratton. Thank you all very much for being members of the Small Council.
And we're back for the storm. We are loud. We are energetic. We are excited for the back half of this podcast to be talking about Lost, one of the most groundbreaking series that can somebody tell me if the smoke monster can travel through time? How does he know what was said in the fucking cabin when Locke's there, like in the 1600s?
Oh, that's a good one. Does the smoke? No, I mean, that's
what I was trying to obliquely bring up.
I understood what you were trying to obliquely bring up. Does it doesn't flash again after the ground covers back over? Does it?
I mean, the last flash that takes John off is like the last flash, and it takes the smoke. Okay, so there's things I've been thinking about, and the one thing is because the smoke monster is part of the light that Jacob and Smokey are actually jumping through with the Losties.
I like it.
Because I would be... at first I was like, well, no, because then he's in like two places with like the stuff that happens with Danielle's group. But like we see lots of people in two places.
That's happening in Danielle's group is like...
Already happened. Yeah. So somewhere else, there's a smoke monster, being someone. But the only reason that makes sense to me is because the fact that Christian shows up in this episode where we get our first hint that the smoke monster can basically, like, puppeteer dead people with Montaigne's voice coming out from underneath
Robert.
The temple.
Oh, Montaigne. Yeah, Montaigne.
I would think at this point the writers know that this is one of the smoke monster's powers, and that's likely what's happening with Christian Shepherd. So it makes it even weirder that back in time, he's very specifically like, back in the cabin, I told you had to move it. And I'm like, we didn't even get to see that Christian Shepherd. How do you know back in with your time traveling?
Yeah.
So the only way I could feel better is if the monster or the man in black and Jacob are so linked to the island that they are also jumping with everybody.
I guess that makes more sense than saying, like, you know, okay, so there are, like, god-level properties and powers that these two dudes have, and could they be experiencing time non-linear, like, you know, all of time all together sort of thing? Like, they know everything that's ever happened. But then... We are eventually going to see that one of them kill the other one, so that feels pretty linear from a time standpoint. So I think that blows it up. It makes more sense that they're moving through time, or that it's just island like magic. It's not. I don't know. Like, It's weird to believe that this Christian Shepherd is the smoke monster and not just like the island telling John what to do. So I can see where you're getting tripped up there. And that makes sense.
I mean, but that's definitely Smokey.
Right. But yeah, that's the thing. We find out later that it is. And I think that's what Dave's saying, is it doesn't entirely make sense for that not to just be the island talking to John, you know?
I think that's really fair, but like it's... I don't know. I still have non-corporeal questions. The smoke monster can touch people and things. So why can this version of him not? Unless he can't touch a candidate. I mean, he can touch a candidate.
Can he touch...
He once dragged John across the jungle floor. Like, he can touch John.
So he can touch things as the smoke monster, but we haven't seen him... touch.
He like when he's John Locke, he punches people and stuff. Like he's touching everything when he's.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he totally can. I just think he can't. He also can't touch the wheel. Like he can't.
Yeah, but he can't. But he can't help John to the wheel.
I mean, he probably could, but he's an asshole. He's the
bad guy. He's just being a jerk. That's fine.
If
the answer is he's not non-corporeal, he's just a jerk, then I am fine with that answer.
If you're building up to John Locke Jesus, which the show is at this point, you torture the fuck out of him, and then you make him move a big wooden thing, and then he dies, and then you bring him back to life. And I think, you know, that's as many biblical connections as I could make right now, but I think, you know, that's basically
you've skirted it long enough. Anyway, go ahead.
It's also entirely possible that he's non-corporeal until John's body returns to the island and he's able to take over the John entity. Like, up to this point, have we seen any of what we believe to be the smoke monster do any touching or act? We just see him in the jungle, right? Or we see him in the cabin. So I think it's entirely possible that whatever the loophole is that he's trying to expose to be able to kill Jacob, it has something to do with his like physicality.
Corporeality. So it's not when he becomes John. It's because he becomes John and then Ben kills Jacob and then he's locked in John's body. So mm-hmm. you're saying that like once he's locked in John's body, that's when he becomes
a physical person. And that explains sort of the long game for him, which is he wants to get off the island, right? He would need a body.
Please nicely send us your smoke monster corporeal thoughts.
Your smoke monster corporeal corrections.
Host at stormpoppodcast.com. Please don't start it with, I can't believe you missed. You usually don't, though. All right, Dave, you've avoided it long enough. You usually love to start this segment with a Locke antagonist check-in. But what do we find this episode, Dave? What do we find? Is Locke the antagonist?
Not now. I mean, not anymore than he has been for following the smoke monster this entire time.
But he doesn't know it's the smoke monster. He's the dupe.
Again, dangerous fate is what I keep going back to. But I will give you the tragedy of this one is this is the first time where I think Locke gives. In talking to Jin, he gives. And that's not something that Locke usually does. Because he knows that he has to get everybody back. It's said to him several times that he has to get everybody back, but he makes that promise to Jin and he means it. So I'm going to give him the not antagonist basically for that, because it's not choosing. He's very directly given the choice to choose a real person or his faith, and he decides to like honor something, even though it could mean everybody dies. That's the protagonist move.
I watched The Life and Death of Jeremy. Like I watched the next couple episodes ahead after we watched this episode because I was doing stuff around the house and it felt like the right thing to do. And like the fact that he does honor Jin's wish here is like essentially what gets him killed by Ben, because Ben is like, John's not willing to go full zealot for this, so I got to do it. So not only that, but like Christian, whoever he may be, you know, basically tells John, like, yeah, do this and you're going to die. And John does it anyway, limping on like a broken leg all the way. And so this is just like such, I mean, like, I think this moment and also The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham, which is such an upsetting episode. And we'll talk about that more. I think that's why people, probably mostly me, but other people push back so hard on your antagonist characteristic, because there's just so much like suffering and sacrifice that John does, especially
We knew from the beginning that this was going to be the part that was hard for me to make this argument, but we also know that I have a whole season coming up where I'm just going to be right, because he will actually be the antagonist.
Are you ready?
So
are you ready?
I'm okay with it.
Are you ready for me to read an email?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. This email comes from...
That's an ominous segue.
This email comes from Aaron, and it's called On the Locke Antagonist Hypothesis. Just curious, so I can better fully grok the L-A-H, Locke Antagonist Hypothesis. Is Matthew Bennell, Donald Sutherland, the antagonist of Invasion of the Body Snatchers? Agent Cooper, the antagonist of Twin Peaks? And Reagan, the antagonist of The Exorcist? A curious listener, Aaron A. Dave?
Oh. I mean, or do I have to keep referring to them as the devils that, like, you know, wear them as a suit? I see what this person is trying to say, which is fine, and I get that that's going to be a chink in my season 6 armor. I think if I'm going to combat that when we do get to season 6 about, you know, how much can you blame a man who is in, you know, some sort of position, I think it comes back to a lot of the choices that made Locke dead and possessible. Because I really think it's not until we get to, what is it, Rose, who, like, calls Man in Black for doing disrespect to, like, Locke's face, and then Jack is able to, like, pile on, from my recollection. But eventually we get there. But a lot of times people are just assuming that's Locke doing things, so we're going to look from their perspective and try to see if John Locke's the antagonist.
We find out they find John's body, and they topple it out of the coffin in dramatic fashion, and Richard's like, WTF, mate. And then we get all smirky smoky. But you're right, there's a few episodes where we're like, is this Locke? What's going on here? All right, I'm gonna reward you instead of reading the next email, which is more on smoky. I'm gonna reward you, Dave, for that really grudging admission with something called The Thematic Resonance of Time Travel on Lost Plus a Little Physics. Are you ready, Dave?
Oh, good. I was hoping an actual person who knew physics would write in.
All right. This is from John Franklin Crenshaw, which is just such a great name that I had to read the whole thing. All right. I've loved all the recent discussion about time travel and Lost and wanted to share my thoughts both from a physics perspective and from a thematic perspective. Firstly, being a physicist myself, specifically a cosmologist, I love the way that Lost handles time travel. The whatever happened, happened model, all right, Joanna, get your mouth together. All right. The whatever happened, happened model of time travel fits in with our understanding of time travel in general relativity, Einstein's theory of space-time. I even love how they throw in a few bootstrap paradoxes, e.g. Locke's compass, as it's mind-bending but also fits with the laws of physics as we know them. And to top it all off, the island moving through time is directly tied to movement through space, i.e. when we jump through time, we also change location, which is exactly how time travel works in general relativity. Don't get me wrong, I don't need my sci-fi to be physically accurate, but I love how they manage to tell such a good story and get a lot of dramatic tension out of the season while also staying pretty close to the science on a number of key points. The story is what really matters, but the physics consistency is the cherry on the top. I was also pleasantly surprised by Dave's quick reference to Kaluza-Klein theory in the Little Prince podcast. KK theory shows that gravity in five space-time dimensions would look like gravity plus electromagnetism to us, and movement of particles through this extremely tiny fifth dimension is what gives them electric charge. This was exciting during the early days of the search for a grand unified theory, as it was an elegant way to get E&M for free out of general relativity. We now know that KK theory isn't correct, one to clear this up in case it sounded like the jury was still out, but it was an important stepping stone on our way to modern theories of extra dimensions such as string theory. But the main thing I want to say is that I think the mechanics of time travel and Lost fit nicely with the show thematically. Much of Lost is about these characters' past, the trauma they've experienced, the mistake they've made, and how they form them into people they are today. In the early seasons, and to be honest, even now, much of the conflict on the show is driven by how these people haven't come to terms with their past. They try to run from it, hide from it, pretend it didn't happen, insist it wasn't fair, rationalize it with lies about some big destiny, etc. So I think it makes so much narrative sense to literally send our characters to the past, explicitly tell them they cannot change it, and watch them try to anyway. Because why try to heal your trauma when you can just detonate a nuclear bomb and erase the last few years of your life? Hey, Dan, do you think you can fix my broken marriage and daddy issues while you're at it? Of course, in a classic time travel trope, their inability to accept what has happened to them and their desperate attempts to erase their past is literally what causes those things in the first place. They cause the incident, which requires someone to push a button every 108 minutes, which does and one day failed to do, crashing Oceana Gate 15. This also leads to the infertility problem, which will lure Juliet to the island in the first place. Saeed attempting to get rid of Ben inadvertently turns him into the monster he will become. Just as they have since day one, these people are still making a mess of their lives because they can't face themselves, their trauma, and one another. Season 6, of course, begins with the realization that it didn't work, because of course it didn't. Have you been paying attention? But this is the perfect launching point for the emotional arc of Season 6, where through the flash sideways, our characters remember their past, especially the traumatic times on the island, and learn to accept what happened to them. They come to peace with their journey and with one another, and finally, after accepting what happened, instead of trying to change it, they are able to move on to something better. I'm being tongue-in-cheek and giving the Losties a hard time, of course. I know from personal experience that it's often so much easier to hide from past trauma rather than face it. But that's the most beautiful part of the final two seasons of Lost. We finally get to see these people we love heal themselves and one another. I think the season 5 time travel is just such a clever piece of the story. I just wish they'd blown up the temple instead and saved us a lot of season 6 drudgery. Let me know what you think. John Franklin Crenshaw. So I know this is like a Dave-centric email, but he talked last time. So, Neil, do you have any reactions to this email?
No, I think I'm continue to be on record as someone who likes the way the time travel is explained on Lost. So this, obviously, I agree with.
Dave?
Yeah. No, I co-sign all of it, and thank you for coming in and doing the physics references to my to connect my story nonsense. I think that John Franklin Crenshaw has a good grasp on where science meets story, where it comes to Lost, I think.
I agree. All right, this one comes from Matthew. This is just a follow-up on something we were talking about, Smokey, last week. Wanted to chime in on the idea of whether the smoke monster predates the Man in Black or not. For what it's worth, the Lost Encyclopedia thinks that he doesn't. I don't know how much we should take the word of the encyclopedia as gospel, but that all seems to match pretty well with what everyone said on the pod last week. But just as a possible counterpoint, there is a fan theory that the mother had some kind of smoke monster power available to her after she knocks the Man in Black out. She seems to single-handedly take out all of the other island occupants. This led to some speculation that Mother had the ability to either summon or become the smoke monster. Damon and Carlton also tease this possibility in the audio commentary for Across the Sea. So... Is Mother the smoke monster? You know, it's a fun question.
Mm-hmm. The energy, at least, seems to predate.
Yeah. Yeah. She's got some real murder energy in her, Alice and Janney. It's true. This email is really long, so I'm going to save it for the future. And then we've got one from... Tim, that's about David Shepherd that I also think I'm going to save for the future. But I love David Shepherd, and I'm really excited to talk about him.
The final Dave.
This last part comes from Luke. This is the second half of Luke's email, where Luke writes, are there any mysteries you wish they had used time fuckery as an explanation for instead of whatever they did do? Ever since Locke said / lied that Jacob sent him to get an in with past Richard in Jughead, I've started to wish that Jacob was a paradox. Just people creating a religion by passing orders and lists through time without even realizing it and creating the illusion of a godhood. Might have allowed for some interesting commentary on religion and the possibility of the final season conflict being a real godlike being, Man in Black, having to battle God as storytelling while trying to break free from destiny. But the stakes being that doing so would cause time apocalypse, a clearer threat than what Smokey being unleashed felt like in the actual season 6, in my opinion. Best wishes, Luke.
It's like a Tenet.
Yeah.
I really like this one because one of my favorite pet theories during this sort of period of Loss was that Jacob was not real. Like, I feel like that was for a while.
Yeah.
The longer and longer the show went on without actually showing us Jacob, it kept showing us people representing Jacob who we had seen before as other right. characters. But Jacob not being real was a very good theory that gets absolutely blown out of the water in the finale of this particular season.
Yeah, Dave, do you have any thoughts on that?
I like that idea of a god that's built out of people and yeah. time shenanigans.
Yeah.
Because it's easy enough just to build a god just out of people. So, like, if that would have been the solution, I would have been, like, great. I was also of team until Jacob showed up. There is no god. So it was weird that an island god would... First of all, I think it started with the name. someone's like, the god's name is Jacob. I'm like, that's a dumb god name. And ever since then, I've been wary of it. But yeah, he does show up. But I think I would have liked it better if Jacob was a little bit more connected to our Losties, because it would have made this whole thing feel like it has incidents more than the battle between the Man in Black and Jacob does, in a way that the emailer mentioned.
I lied. We do have one last email section. It's from the earlier, longer email that I read from Eric. It's a very long email. There's a quick section where he talks about one of his favorite theories at the time being that Ben's telescoping rod is actually a time-space travel control rod.
Ooh.
there's a screenshot and everything. I'll send it to you, Dave.
It's like hit. It's like Ben's sonic screwdriver.
Yeah. But here's this, and this actually helped me clarify some questions I had around, like, when we were talking about, like, whose plan is it anyway? Whose plan is it to get everyone back to the island? What's going on? Who's pulling the strings? Why is it advantageous to the Man in Black? Why would it be advantageous to Jacob? Whose idea is it, right? So Eric writes, with regards to the Jacob discussions, I think it's much easier to square the circle of many of the plot elements if you believe that Jacob is also actively working towards creating the circumstances for his own death. His goal is to free himself from the burden of the island, create a final confrontation that will defeat the Man in Black, and leave the island to someone else. But he is fully aware he will need someone to die and is actively working to create the same loophole Man in Black is to create the circumstances that will result in Ben killing him. He has that quote, it only ends once, everything else is progress or something, which I think is a pretty decent indicator. But also there's all sorts of other island magic or Jacob. It's always unclear what is just the island and what is Jacob directing decisions that are leading to his eventual death. But there's also simpler things, like he's a pretty big dick to Ben. That makes a lot more sense if his goal is to set up the circumstances for Ben to kill him. So there you go. Just like when thinking about what Jacob's motivation is, it's like to defeat the Man in Black, yes, but part of that I think is he knows he has to die in order to do that. So he's engineering some things that maybe seem counter to his own self-interest, but his self-interest is his own death. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. You can only save the day right at the edge when everything's almost lost.
Well, also, that's
when everybody's vulnerable.
He's just so old that he's like, I am ready to go.
I'm done with this.
You ever just had one of those days? Imagine having one of those, like, last 100 years.
Millennia.
You're just, like, ready to go.
Yeah.
Then they invented cell phones, and now I have to blip the island every other, just, like, year. This is so annoying. All right. Do we have any discussion points that we definitely want to hit on amongst the three of us? There's a couple here, but I feel like we've talked about incorporeal ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. How is essential is Desmond's little errand for Dan? Pretty inessential, right?
Desmond's
errand for Dan.
Dan says, go find my mom and she'll help you rescue me.
Dan's errand for Desmond.
Yeah.
Sorry, cool.
Strike that, reverse it. Dan's errand for Desmond, which is find my mom. And that involves Desmond in this season, but it's sort of like everything that happened in Indiana Jones would have happened without Indiana Jones, right?
Yes,
like,
that's true.
Like, they're all headed towards the church and Eloise anyway. So Desmond being like, oh, yeah, that lady, go find her. Oh, you're already here? Okay, cool. I'm going to go. It positions him to be nearby for Ben. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And positions him for Charles Widmore to capture him. But once again, it just, to my point that I've been making, it just sort of feels like they're trying really hard to keep Desmond involved in the plot, when actually, like, this hunt for Eloise is not essential to.
Yeah.
When we do the Ajira flight, which is the next episode, weirdly enough, when we do the Ajira flight, like, Desmond's not involved in that. So he has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. He just leaves.
I think it's just as much with having him meet Teresa. Like, I think we needed to get Desmond to Oxford. We didn't need to get Desmond to LA, you know, in terms of, like, his purpose in the story.
Mm.
Otherwise, you're absolutely correct. At this point in Los Angeles, I think we're meant to forget because other more exciting things are happening. Why isn't Dan Charlotte's constant if she met him when she was a little girl?
Good question.
I mean, I guess the answer is that...
Why isn't Charlotte Dan's constant?
No.
Okay.
Why isn't Dan Charlotte's constant? Okay. So, but that, I mean, I wrote this, but like me writing that presumes that time disease is the same as Frater disease. Because in Frater disease, you need a constant, right? Time disease is a little different, but her brain is skipping around through time. And Dan says the solution to that is to have a constant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And Dan's constant is Desmond.
Oh, I know what, I know why.
Why?
Because Dan appears in two time periods. Not,
but so does Desmond.
He meets him in two. That version of Desmond goes and finds Dan, and then Dan goes to the island where a different version of Desmond. It's literally the same Dan. So how would you be able to anchor yourself in time if the same Dan appears in your childhood and your moment of death? I think that's why she goes back to the chocolate immediately, because even if she was trying to anchor, because you're right, it would be he would be the perfect anchor, but the exact same Dan shows up in...
You mean because he's the same age? Is that what you mean by exact same?
I mean, he's like actually, like, Desmond's consciousness is traveling through time. His body's still on the boat. But Dan's entire being is traveling through time. Does that make any sense?
No.
Desmond can have Penny because there's no point in the Desmond time looping or the Penny storyline where they either physically travel through time. But Desmond's constant can't be Dan. Dan's constant can be Desmond. But if you have someone who's physically skipping through time, they can't be a constant because they aren't constant.
So Charlotte's constant would need to be someone that Charlotte knew earlier in her life who is on the same, basically, time, in the same time lane, right?
Yeah, I also think it's like they're both physically skipping. Not only is Dan sort of like a time anomaly in Charlotte's life, but they're both drowning. Like, just because Charlotte's drowning faster doesn't mean that Dan doesn't have like the time sickness. Like, it would be like tossing an anchor onto another sinking boat. Like, it doesn't anchor you. Does that make more sense? Like, Dan skipping, Charlotte skipping, you need a constant to stop skipping, but nobody's not skipping. Penny is always on one timeline. Desmond is always on one timeline.
Even though his consciousness is hopping around.
Even though his consciousness is not.
So it has to do with your body, not your consciousness or whatever.
Well, I think it would be hard because, if you're trying to throw like this weird time / consciousness anchor and it's based on a relationship, there's a time period in Charlotte's life where there's a baby Dan and there's an adult Dan existing at the same time. So who, like, that person seems like it wouldn't be a good constant. That doesn't happen for Desmond or Penny or any of the people that we establish as constants.
Here's what Dan says about a constant.
Yeah.
A constant is an object or person that exists in both periods of times that the traveler deeply cares about and could recognize. There's already an issue with that because we're like, how is Desmond Dan's constant? Dan doesn't deeply care about Desmond, so it doesn't make any sense that he gives that speech and then the same episode picks Desmond. If a constant is not found, the oscillation between different times will become more frequent and chaotic until the individual dies from what appears to be severe brain aneurysm. An object or person that exists in both periods of time. I hear what you're saying. I'm not saying it's totally illogical. I think that Dan appearing in the past and Dan being in the present there with Charlotte fits under Dan's own definition of what a constant is.
I think I have a theory let me try this. So an example of a constant, an appropriate constant for Charlotte would be if our losties came upon a new Dharma station that was like another hatch and they opened it up and they found Charlotte's father. Would he yes. then be a good constant for, because he is moving the same way through time. He has not skipped through time.
For Dave's theory about what a constant should be, but I'm just saying, like,
Yeah, that's. I'm trying to understand Dave's theory. And,
yeah.
And it. I think it makes sense.
It kind of makes sense, but he's introducing a new, like footnote to that's never explicitly stated in the show. Dave's invented his own rule for what a constant needs to be, and that's fine. And that's fine, but I'm not.
Well,
I'm
it makes sense that, like, that's what happened. So, like, let's say Dan does tell Charlotte that she needs to find a constant. It's just off screen. And Charlotte decides that it's going to be Dan because Dan's right there with her. So she's jumping through time, trying to latch on to talking to Dan. And she does, but it's the chocolate Dan and she dies.
Oh, chocolate Dan, so useless. Yeah.
Because she's trying to do what you're suggesting, Joanna, and what they were able to do with Penny, because Penny isn't moving through time, but she just latches onto a Dan that's also skipping through time. Therefore, Dan's an ineffective constant, and that's like what kills her, because that's not where her brain is. That's where her consciousness decides to go. It's weird. Her and like the Mikowski, where do they go? Off into time.
So and Penny is a constant because she's only moving through time normally.
At any just time, if you were to talk Christmas. To Penny. Yeah, if any time you were able to, like, in the future time, reunite with Penny, it would definitely not be a Penny from the future of the past. It would just be the Penny. Mm-hmm. The constant Penny.
Oh, the constant Christmas Penny. Oh, Christmas Penny. All right, let's leave that there. If anyone has any constant theories, if you agree with Dave's a body in motion must stay in time motion in order to be a constant, chocolate Dan ideas, let us know. Host at stormpodcast.com.
Chocolate Dan.
Oh, Chocolate Dan. I once saw Chocolate Dan open for Geronimo Jackson. Yeah. All right, so... one of our listeners mentioned this during the live watch. Is this the last time Sun talks to her daughter ever?
Probably.
Maybe.
We also never see the dog again. So that dog's dead.
Well, I mean, eventually.
We're all dead eventually, right? Except Vincent. Vincent becomes the new Richard. Yeah, I think this is the last time Sun talks to her daughter. You guys have done full rewatches.
I mean, next time we see her, she's on the plane. She might have called her daughter one more time before she got on the plane, but she specifically requests a more recent photo, and I think that's what they show Jin in season 6. It's the photos on her phone or whatever. I think that's right. I think this might be the last time she talks to her daughter, which is really sad.
It is sad. And then maybe Sun will meet her new or maybe Jiyeon would meet her new friend Aaron just with her real mom. With Aaron's real mom and no Jian mom. It's a man.
It's that they'll all be in the church sequel. In the end.
It's fine. Yeah. Yeah, it's fine.
I think we should all go live with Cassidy. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is the temple, and I know that like we're running long, so we don't need to like go all the way into it. I was trying to track the history of the temple before we started talking about it, so I'd have all my ducks in a row. But it's a little dicey in terms of like the others occupying it, but the smoke monster living below it, like, but he can't go in it later because they got the ash there. So like, but they push the ash down, but they put the ash down only after Jacob dies. That's when they know they're in danger. So like the permeability of the temple and like why it's safe and when it's not and where the smoke monster exists underneath it. I have a lot of questions about that. But yeah. The Lostpedia has a lengthy list of unanswered questions about the temple. Are you ready to hear them?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure.
Who built the temple? When and why? Why did the temple have its own Dharma logo on Ben's map? What happened to Rousseau's team underneath the temple? Why did the others feel it was important to keep outsiders from seeing the temple? What is the monster's connection to the temple? And in terms of the healing spring, how were the spring's healing properties discovered? why did the spring change color? So, like, they're just, like, I, like, Jake, what's tough here at the end is they know they've only got a season to go. They introduce all this temple stuff. And I'm like, why? just why? And I know that most people
did
feel
that
way.
Did you not have enough questions to answer?
I'm like, you guys have plenty of other mystery you got to unravel. You want to introduce this freaking temple with all these weird rules to it? Why? So that's all. I just wanted to say why to the temple.
Why temple?
I want to start the why temple now because we're
in
just
season
gonna keep...
5, episode 5. Joanna asked, "Why temple?
Why temple? Why?" Yeah, and the last thing I want to say is that the next episode was originally supposed to be episode 7, but they flip-flopped them. In fact, the next 3 episodes, someone mentioned in our Slack that you can watch the next 3 episodes in any order, and since they don't sort of overlap, it all works, which could kind of be true. Mm-hmm. But I think the end of LaFleur really only works if it comes after 3:16. But... I was looking around, I couldn't figure out why, but I'm wondering why they flip-flopped them.
Dave knows the answer.
Oh, Dave knows the answer. Hit me, Dave.
So both of these episodes were written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, and they realized they could be in whatever order that they wanted, and they decided, I think based on the official podcast, they mentioned that they decided to flop these two because they thought that the life and death of Jeremy Bentham should come after 3:16 for some mysterious reason they don't outline on the official podcast. This is definitely a Damon and Carlton wrote them both, realized they wrote them in the wrong order.
Did they say sort of like, because I was wondering if maybe it was a reaction to, I mean, this feels like too short of a window to be reactive. But I do know that some people were like, the LA plot, like, just, we know they're going back. Just get them back already, was sort of a reaction that was going on. And they're back as of, you know, the next episode starts with Jack on the island. So, like, no more shilly-shallying in LA. We'll get some more LA backstory, but, like, you know. So I was almost wondering if it was that, but that just feels like very reactive. We're still so early in the season, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you could see a scenario in which the writer's room felt like that. You know, like if they started to feel like as they were writing the season, like, all right, it's time to bring our beloved Jack back to the island. They really like Jack.
Get Jack back to the island. all right, I think that's gonna do it for this week. Neil, we were just talking about it, but remind me where we're going next week.
Well, yeah, we were just talking about Jack. It is a Jack episode, 3:16. I would argue this is a pretty good trilogy of episodes. You watch them, we're gonna watch them in order, but any order, it's true. All three are just bangers.
It's gonna be a good February here at the Storm of Lost Rewatch Podcast. Until next week, where we go to Jiroflight 3:16, where can people find more of your work around the internet, Mr. Neil Miller?
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects, at one perfect shot. And we are finishing up in our Slack, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, the Deadwood live watch, and we're very close to picking a new show. So if you're waiting for a good reason to join our Patreon, there's another one.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I do a podcast about WandaVision called Still Watching WandaVision. This week we have Kat Dennings on the podcast. Fun fact, our Slack, our Patreon Slack, has a really good WandaVision channel where there's like a lot of fun theories. It's like, I don't like to play favorites of the channels, but that's definitely one of my favorites right now. So the WandaVision channel is really fun in our Patreon Slack. And I do another podcast called Little Gold Men, where we are discussing award season. This week we will be talking about the Golden Globes and the SAGs, which will be announced this week, I believe. So there you go.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room Pop Culture Podcast, where we've been on a Washington kick talking about Tenet and The Little Things. You could figure it out by watching both those movies. Yeah. People get it when they watch both the movies. Until then, I'll be here every week talking to you about Lost and reminding you to not fall down.